Thank you all. I'm going to talk today about some of my work on sea level rise and saltwater intrusion and its effects on nutrient release from agricultural systems. Our seas are rising, as we all know, across the globe. And along the eastern seaboard of the U.S., we have sea level rise rates that are about 3 times the global average. Sea level rise leads to a phenomenon called saltwater intrusion, which is the landward movement of sea salts. And so this photo is taken with your back, you can imagine, to a loblolly pine forest, and you're looking out towards that. In the background, there's a marsh that's starting to move inland. And these forests are known as ghost forests. They look as if they've been burned by fire, but it's actually salt damage because of the osmotic stress that saltwater intrusion causes to vascular plants. However, forests are not the only land use type. Upslope from the saltwater intrusion regions, all this red area in the figure here are coastal areas that are in danger of shallow coastal flooding, and a lot of that land is farmland. And in fact, this area where the research that I'm conducting is located is where some of the first farms are in the entire United States. So when the British and the Dutch came in the 1600s and started to settle, these colonies were in these regions, and so some of the farmlands that are affected are truly some of the first farms in America. And because of their long land use history, so some of these have been in production for many hundreds of years, and then in addition to that, the new land use changes in terms of the switch from the tobacco farming that was really had a stronghold in Maryland to now grain farming, it makes it really difficult to predict what's going to happen. We have a lot of land use legacies that are locked into these soils. And so currently, the current land use practice is that almost all, if not 100% of the grain that's produced on the eastern shore of Maryland goes to feed chickens, such as these little guys here. And in 2015, Maryland produced about 300 million pounds of meat chickens. And as we know, chicken manure has really high levels of phosphorus. And historically, a lot of that poultry manure is applied to neighboring farm fields. And so agriculture clearly has been indicated in land use or in water quality issues in the Chesapeake Bay. It's responsible for about 38% of the nitrogen loading, 45% of the phosphorus loading, and 60% of the sediment loading in the Chesapeake Bay. However, you can imagine that on some level we've been sort of thinking of these agricultural systems as non-point sources. But if you look at a figure like this, where you see the proximity of a farm field to a tidal creek, you can imagine that some of these farms may need to be thought of more as point sources or nutrient hotspots. And that's really what I've been interested in researching. So when saltwater intrusion occurs on a field, it looks something like this. For lack of a better word, I've been calling these intrusion spikes. If you have a better term, let me know. And it looks like sort of like a finger that's being pushed into the center of the field. The ditch would be to your back as you're looking towards the center. And so unlike freshwater flooding, if this was a freshwater system, saltwater is very complex. It's high in ionic strength, in base cations. It's also high in alkalinity, and it has a lot of sulfate in it as well. And so if you've ever taken Soil Chem 101, the first thing that you do when you learn how to extract nitrogen from a soil is you add salt. So we're seeing incredibly high levels of nitrogen being extracted, essentially, from these soils, mostly in the form of ammonium. We're also seeing really high levels of phosphorus being extracted from these soils for two reasons. One, the soils are flooded, so the iron 3 is being reduced to iron 2, and then that phosphate gets bumped off. And also because sulfur can compete with iron on those iron complexes and sort of play a game of musical chairs with phosphorus, then phosphorus loses out, and you have more phosphate in solution and more of that sulfate being bound to your iron surfaces. And so this is just some quick data to show you that, yes, these are really salty farms. So I have the data here in salinity in PPT. We can show this, and I can talk about the desicemens, but these are mesohaline levels in farm fields. So these are collected samples from lysimeters that are installed at two different depths. This is the salt tolerance of corn way down here. This is what we're growing on the fields, by the way, soy, corn, and wheat. This is soy, and that's wheat. So pretty much across the board, we are trying to grow crops that are not appropriate for the levels of salinity that we're seeing in these fields. And so we end up with fields that look a lot like this. So most of the fields end up sort of on the fringe areas looking something like this. We have some soybeans on the left. We have this red sand spurry, which is a halophyte sort of ground cover, right sort of on the edge of the soy. We have this characteristic bare area, and then we're seeing very traditional brackish marsh species. That's distichlis and salt marsh hay, or Spartina alternifolia. And so this, and you can see this is all in one photo on an iPhone. So this is not a large area where we're seeing a really, really stark transition in both the plant community and then also the soils. So the data I'm going to show you are just one sort of part of our study where we took soil cores along these transects, and we're looking at some of the effects that we're going to see in both the soil iron and the soil phosphorus along that transect. So what we would expect to see is that in these areas that are not as prone to flooding, we would expect that iron would be in a more crystalline form. That means it would have a lower cation exchange capacity, a lower surface area, and a more regular pattern. But as these fields get flooded, we would expect some of that iron to sort of dissolve into these non-crystalline forms, which allow for a higher cation exchange capacity and a greater surface area, which basically would mean on some level it might be more capable of holding on to both phosphorus and organic matter. And so just to sort of step back again and show you this photo, the main sort of idea of this whole project is to try to figure out what is going to happen when some of these farms go underwater, and what are some of the management solutions that we might be able to give to farmers now so that we don't have really large pulses of nitrogen and phosphorus going into these tidal creeks as these farms start to go get more and more intruded by salt water. So this is our study area. We're working on six farms on the Lower Eastern Shore of Maryland. I'm only going to show you data today from three farms where we actually conducted these transition studies. So this is what those spikes look like from Google Earth. It just so happened that we had three fields that were in three different parts of the corn, soy, and wheat rotation, lucky us, that first year. And so when you zoom in, this is on one of the soy fields. This is that transition spike that I was talking about. And basically, you have this ditch followed by the ditch edge, this characteristic bare area, the edge of the crop, and then the crop. So that's where we collected our soil samples along each of those points. And then we also have lysimeters, which are suction lysimeters, which we installed at three different locations along that transect. And so we cored down to 140 centimeters, more or less, sort of depended on the soil horizon. And then that's a picture of what our lysimeters look like in the field. We did a ton of soil physical and chemical analyses, and I'm not going to talk about all of these today. I'm just going to focus on these ones highlighted in green. So I'll show you Malic 3, which is the sort of what we use for the traditional soil P test, which is whether or not you're allowed to apply more poultry manure to your farm. Sodium bicarbonate, which the data look very similar to our Malic 3, is sort of another measure of available phosphorus. Some sulfate and chloride data. We're going to look at the non-crystalline iron as well as the total iron. If we have time, we'll talk about organic matter too. So we'll start just looking at whether or not we see sort of this salty signature in the soil. And the answer is yes, we do. So if you look on the right, that's where we took the samples in the ditch, and then you're moving in towards the crop field, and you can see we have really high concentrations of both sulfate and chloride as we move from that ditch edge into the fields. And so now I'm going to show you a couple of these figures. This is malic extractable phosphorus. This little arrow here is where once you've reached 150 micrograms per gram of phosphorus, that is your cutoff. You're no longer allowed to apply any more phosphorus. That's considered high. So you can already tell by our little Y or axes down there that we're going to be blowing that out of the water. So we have really high phosphorus concentrations in these fields, and we're seeing this really interesting sort of subsurface lateral movement of the phosphorus as we might expect from those crops in towards the ditch edge. Imagining that those sort of that along that spike, you're seeing that sort of sucking out of the phosphorus along that transition. And that'll end up in the ditch, and indeed we see really high concentrations of phosphate in the ditch water. The bicarbonate data show a very similar story, again, sort of that subsurface lateral movement of phosphorus from the center of the field towards the ditch. And so now I'll show you some data on the iron. So this is total iron, and we can see that the iron is pretty much the same across that whole transition, but when you start to look at the different kinds of iron, we do see this increase in the non-crystalline or that sort of stickier iron as we move towards the ditch edge, as we would expect in a regime where you see a lot of flooding. And so what does that mean? So this is what it means. When you step out and look across the landscape, this is looking at fields and flooded fields, flooded forests and marshes. So we're looking across these landscapes, both in these flooded fields and forests. We're seeing incredibly high concentrations of phosphate being released into these marshes, these tidal marshes. So that little dashed line there is the EPA value for what's considered to be a eutrophic water body. So we are orders of magnitude higher than that in these marshes in terms of the amount of phosphorus that is being released from these farm fields. And it's a very similar pattern for ammonium. So really high concentrations of ammonium that are accumulating in these marshes, in these tidal marshes, as they drain off of these farm fields. And so our conclusion is that indeed some of these farm fields are probably going to be hot spots. And as we move forward, we really need to think about what kind of management strategies are necessary in order to try to mitigate some of this sort of, to mitigate these nutrient releases, because sea level rise is happening. It's going to keep happening. Saltwater intrusion is going to keep happening. Farmers have a couple different strategies for dealing with it. But ultimately, it's a process that we can't stop. And so we need to work with farmers now and start to think about what we're going to do in order to maybe create alternative crop species that can be grown and start to promote those, or maybe looking into the CREP program and finding ways to subsidize some of those lands coming out of agriculture so they can be remediated. And farmers are doing that already. So just to summarize, we see these really high rates across the eastern seaboard of sea level rise, and these farmlands that are some of America's first farmlands are going underwater. The intrusion on these fields is leading to large concentrations of nutrients being released into water bodies. In terms of phosphorus, we see it moving across these fields and into ditches, and this frequent flooding is changing the soil iron structure, which has a lot of effects on the reactivity of the iron. We can talk more about potentially what that means for organic matter as well. And then solution phosphorus and nitrogen is also moving across these landscapes and accumulating in marshes. So we are seeing that some of these fields are hotspots, and we need to think about our new what sort of conservation and mitigation efforts are going to be necessary to try to remediate some of that, some of the nutrient release. Spoke really fast, but I have a lot of people to thank, all of my students in the lab, and of course all of my farmer partners who let me tromp around on their fields and take a bunch of soil, of course. Thanks. So I think I have a couple, like a minute or two. I have a minute for questions.
No questions.
Yeah. Gosh, that's a tough question. So there's sort of three things that farmers are doing. One is, there's like a very typical social paradigm, sociology paradigm that this fits into. So some farmers are just building up their fields. They're actually like finding soil and trying to make their fields taller. Some farmers are switching to alternative crops, so they're sort of adapting. And some farmers are like abandoning altogether. We have a lot of lands that we're now able to sort of look at what's happening on these abandoned fields. And some farmers are going so far as to say, hey, this used to be a wetland. Why don't I turn this back into a wetland and then sell the hunting rights? So you could almost think of that as being an alternative crop. It's an alternative, you know, form of income. And so we're working with farmers who are taking all of those different tactics, and we're, you know, in some ways we're just trying to see what is the most economical. I mean, we have some trials right now to look at different potentially salt tolerant species that could maybe be grown for a couple of years. But some of these lands are so bad. I mean, if you like lick your finger and then it's salt, I mean, it tastes, the salt is, it's super salty. And you can see it from Google Earth, those images. I mean, it's really clear what's happening. And unless you can get a perennial grass to take root, so like switchgrass, maybe not even for biofuel, just to try to get something with some deep roots in there for a little while, you might be able to then mow it down and plant another crop. But it's a really tough issue. And I will say that it's very sensitive. Farmers don't really want people to know this is happening, because they're really worried about insurance rates, and they don't necessarily want a lot of attention. They are trying to deal with it in some ways in secret. But it's a really sort of sad place to work too, because this area almost everyone has moved out. It's like you'll drive down some of these roads and they end in water, and all along the way are like houses that you can tell people just left. Left their car, left, and they're never coming back. So we have to sort of think about what are we going to do that is going to be appropriate both economically but also environmentally. And this is why I like to work in this area. It's really tricky to walk that line.